So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. I'm Nate Larkin.
I'm David Hampton.
And this is our special holiday edition of the show.
It is. I'm glad to be doing this,
Nate.
Because the holidays are tricky for everybody, but especially those of us in recovery and our friends that are maybe in new recovery and how to anticipate this and what to expect. And
yeah, that's good. It's nice that you've dressed for the occasion, too. I like that you wore a wreath today.
Thank you. And the antlers aren't too much?
No.
Okay. All right. I just, you never know where to quit on the,
I know.
What we've done, we now are apparel or whatever.
Yeah.
So.
Boy, it is true, certainly, that the holidays can really be a challenge to anybody walking in recovery.
Yeah.
Especially early on.
Yeah. Yeah. I am seeing people daily in my office that just don't know what to do with the loneliness, with the expectation, with the comparative thinking. You know, it's so much more than how do I go to the company Christmas party and not drink?
Mm-hmm.
Or how
mm-hmm.
do I, turn down something that might trigger me or something
like that.
It is so much more about the pervading belief that in this particular time of year, maybe more than others, my life lacks.
Yeah.
I lack, and
yeah.
I'm empty. And Advent is this season of waiting. We celebrate Advent in some of our more liturgical circles, and it's the season of waiting, and it can be a season of dark before the light.
For a lot of us.
Yeah.
And it can also, we know that addiction is rooted in trauma, and it can also trigger traumatic memory.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get personal for a minute. Let's just back up. What was holiday time, specifically Christmas time, like for you when you were a kid?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I was a kid, we had, in the house I grew up in until I was about 13, we had an upstairs tree in the living room that was either a white flocked tree with mm-hmm. all red ornaments,
mm-hmm.
you know. My mom, that was sort of like the decorator tree.
That was the
one that, you know, everybody saw. And except for the one year where we did get the aluminum tree and the light that rotated and changed colors to make it, you know, really special. That was the psychedelic tree that year. But no, that upstairs tree was like the off-limits tree. That was the pretty tree. And then downstairs in the family room where we all spent most of our time was mm-hmm. the tree where all the handmade ornaments and the ornaments we had all brought home from, you know, Sunday school or school projects or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Those hung on the family tree. And somehow, you know, that those two trees might have even represented something more than Christmas trees, you know, because there's the tree that everybody sees when they come in upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
That is a beautiful tree that you see from the street, and it's, you know, and my mom always did a great job with the red and all that. But the tree that I loved that had my heart was the one that had the memories.
Oh, wow.
You know, the one that represented stuff.
Yeah.
That where real life hung on it. It
wasn't
as pretty. It wasn't as pristine. It wasn't, gorgeous. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And it got to be the thing that held all the all the family treasures.
Sure, sure.
And we had, you know, Christmas Eve where we would open the one gift, you know, and then the Santa Sunday or Christmas morning rather.
Yeah.
And those were all the big moment things. We had a lot of family gatherings and things like that. Christmas was a big time, but I also remember that we had a lot of expectations of ourselves at Christmas, and a lot of expectations of one another, and things like that. And so I think that in as much as it was beautiful and it was a great time together, it also represented a lot of things needed to be really special. And so I think it was a little bit like my life, you know. They were kind of things that needed to be really special, and we were going to make them that way, but there were things that were just like the family Christmas tree that had the raw, less pristine moments, and those were probably the ones that that were the most treasured.
What
about you?
Well, you know, I grew up in a big family, and we were poor. Didn't always know that we were poor, but we didn't have much money. So we never went actually and bought a tree off a Christmas tree lot. We would scout some. Dad would scout one out in the woods somewhere, and we'd buy one. And it always, you know, was it had special needs, our tree. So you rotate it just the right way. And put on those multicolored, you know, taco shop lights. And, you know, the icicles. The whole deal. There was a lot of tension in our house throughout the year, especially after my dad's remarriage. Just always, it felt like you were walking on eggshells around the house. Step in the door to kind of take the emotional temperature of the house. How safe is it today? But Christmas, at least for a few hours on Christmas morning, there seemed to be a respite from that. I think that was the greatest part of Christmas, was I felt like we were most as advertised on Christmas morning. There was never a lot under the tree. There were 8 kids when I was home, 2 more after I left. But you'd get an article of clothing, either store-bought or homemade, and you'd get a toy, or occasionally something big. I remember the year I got a shotgun. That was quite a deal. And also, Christmas Eve was big. My dad was a pastor in a small country church, and there would be the Christmas pageant, typically on Christmas Eve. The shepherds in bathrobes, and the baby Jesus borrowed from my little sister's toy collection, doll collection. Typically, the congregation would give a Christmas present. They'd take up a special secret. They'd pass the hat, and they'd give my dad money on Christmas Eve. That was like the big bonus. In a way, it was kind of like if your dad was a mail carrier, you know. The Christmas tips. One of my most vivid memories is a Christmas Eve when Dad declared after the service that he was going to take us all to dinner. Now, I'd never been to a restaurant. And it was snow. It was a blizzarding. But Dad packed us all into the big country squire station wagon and drove us into Watertown, the closest city, about 25 miles away. But he didn't know that the restaurants would be closed on Christmas Eve. Only one that was open also had a bar, and Dad was not going to take his family into a restaurant that served alcohol. So instead, we got a real treat. They went to the IGA, which was still open, and bought 10 TV dinners. We'd never had TV dinners. Quite a treat. Salisbury steak and fried chicken. And we got back home, and it took forever, of course, to warm them up in the oven. So I have great Christmas memories of our early years of marriage with the kids. It was always Allie was really good at doing Christmas and make it so magical.
Yeah.
And I think I was a little less crazy as an addict and a little more present on Christmas morning than at other times.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, now that we're older and we're empty nesters and, you know, our daughter hosts Christmas, the holidays are different.
Yeah. I remember Tricia and I almost getting a divorce over a Lion King tent for Lauren. You know, Christmas Eve and putting the
assembling
damn thing
the
together.
Damn toys.
Exactly. And there's no, you know, there is no clarity. And Tricia was all about instructions. I was all about
that's right.
You know, this trial and error.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And oh my gosh. Yeah, we had it out. Santa and Mrs. Claus were going at it in the living room. And that was, you know, back when I was still drinking. And so I was probably at least, you know,
three sheets to
the evening before I even attempted the tent, which made it even more, you know. Wonder why I have leftover parts.
Yeah.
There lives a video archive of me the next morning when Lauren is, you know, up and scampering into the living room to see her Lion King tent all set up and assembled. And the camera pans over to me, and I'm on the couch in a bathrobe, and I'm every bit what you'd expect at 6 a.m. on a Christmas morning after being up drinking, putting together toys. It's not the real, you know, it was not my greatest moment and on film either. But
and you know, I picked up my first prostitute on a Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
On my way to host a Christmas Eve service. Why that night? Whether there's any significance to that, I don't know.
Yeah. I had my first drink over the Christmas season when I was 13.
There you go.
You know, my parents had the bottle that a colleague of my dad had given him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always joke when I speak that they didn't know what to do with it, whether to give it to people or to keep it. And if they gave it to people, it would maybe contribute to somebody else's problem. So they just put it in the back of the pantry behind the baked goods where I now know Baptists keep their liquor. but honestly, I was mesmerized by that bottle.
Yeah.
And it was like having a body buried under the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And my parents went to a Christmas party one night. I was 13, and, you know, most alcoholics can tell you their first drink.
Yeah.
And I went in, and my mom had the tumblers. They were juice glass. They were actually on the rocks glasses, but we called them juice glasses. And it was the 70s, so they had mallard ducks on them, and everything did in the 70s. And so, you know, I poured. I didn't know how to really mix a drink. My parents didn't drink, and my aunt and uncle, who were Methodists, did. And they had a zebra skin bar and red carpet in their family room in the 70s, and so they were very cool people.
Yeah.
And I had watched them mix drinks. And so I filled this glass with about halfway Kentucky bourbon and the other half Sprite with ice.
Wow.
And I went in and watched Charlie Brown on TV in the paneled family room with the tree lights on and had my first drink.
Yeah.
And I remember about 20 minutes in realizing that I had been lied to.
Mm-hmm.
This was not terrible. I was not going to act unbecomingly. I was not getting sick. I actually liked the taste.
Yeah.
And the warmth and the warm hug that came over me.
Yeah.
I didn't feel anxious, perfectionistic, less than. God loved me a whole lot more in that moment than I'd ever experienced before.
Yeah.
And I always say I never, you know, understood people praying for peace when Bacardi sells it for $9.99.
And
that's when I first pressed pause in my psyche and said, this is going to be a part of my life.
Yeah.
And it was a romantic attachment to that experience, I think, that even now, to be really honest, even now, I can be at home or if I'm in a place, you know, there's a Christmas tree and we're sitting around with friends or whatever in someone's home, that romance can come over me and I can still have that thought of, I could have one.
Right. You're right. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just for a minute, this is,
Yes. This cake just needs a little frosting.
That's exactly, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because this moment, the only thing that could make it better is if I, you know, just had a little bit less of me.
Now, you know, I'm fortunate in that my marriage survived my addiction. A lot of my friends have not been so lucky.
Yeah.
So they've paid a price for their behavior, and their families paid a price. And so they're now living in the reality of fractured relationships, which make holidays especially challenging.
Right.
So whether they're shuttling the kids from one parent's home to another, whether they are maybe for the sake of the kids spending an hour in the same room together, or whether they're shut out completely. This isn't this year to have the kids, or this is not the year they can show up at the family gathering.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they're alone.
Yeah.
On either Thanksgiving or Christmas or New Year's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It can be a time when that old comforting friend calls very loudly, and it can be, we could start now to run through our minds the narrative of all that we've lost and all that's been taken from us and all the many ways in which we've messed up. And it can seem as though the rest of the world is at a party we're excluded from.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. Because our culture is so steeped in comparative thinking now, more than ever, I think, with social media and all of that. You know, we put our best outsides out there, and the holidays just seem to take that on to another level, a whole other level of expectation of why am I alone? This family looks like, you know, the Christmas card that I wanted and maybe had, like you're saying, you know, at one point, you know, that was my life too.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't experience it out of divorce and isolation from the standpoint that my marriage didn't make it. You know, when Trisha passed away and my daughter moved out and she's married and now we have a new little grandbaby to celebrate this Christmas. But in the years in between that, you know, there would be that time where, excuse me, I would go home and feel like, you know, that used to be my life. Yeah. Why am I alone?
Yeah.
You know, I've been here with these people. I've been there with these people, but I want somebody to connect with too.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be known and to know someone and have an experience of intimacy for the holiday that I'm watching other people seem to have.
Yes.
You know. And those were that comparative thinking is very, very hard. And I think it's understandable and natural, and we have to give ourselves permission to experience that. But that alone, in a moment where other people, you're keenly aware more than other times that other people today are not.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and you can only, you know, sit in Starbucks so long on holidays.
So the name of this podcast is the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So, David, Mr. Peer Addiction Counselor.
I thought you were going to call me Mr. Positive. I'm disappointed. I'm sorry, but go ahead.
Yeah. What positive steps that can I take? What can I do on the holidays that will help keep me away from the edge?
You know, I tell people all the time, and I tell myself this, it is like picking up the 100-pound phone when you have to call a friend in recovery, and you have to make the call. Let people know you are alone, and that is so antithetical to our nature.
Sure.
What kind of loser do you want me to go out and sell myself as? I'm not going to tell people I'm alone on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, right.
Freaking kidding me?
Right.
I
don't want to be the fifth wheel anywhere.
Exactly.
And I don't want pity.
Yes, I don't want that ninth place setting at the end of the table
right.
where they pull a bar stool up for me to sit at to be me, you know?
Yeah.
But let people know that you are alone. Let people know you're around.
Yes.
Call. Make connections with friends. Mm-hmm. Find out if there are some friends that maybe you host
yes.
something. You know, you may not have a huge place, but maybe three people can come over.
Yeah.
I really encourage people to be proactive and take responsibility for some of the space that we have in our lives mm-hmm. and how to fill that, what to do with that. My daughter's in-laws graciously invited me to Christmas Eve last year, and they have a number of grandchildren on their side of the family, and there's a lot of things that are going on, a lot of just a lot of energy, you know. And it was great to be there. I wasn't expecting to go. My tendency was to say, no, that's your family, Lauren, right. you and PJ go and enjoy right. yourself and enjoy that family. And but I was like, no, I will go. You know, I have a particular Christmas Eve service that the Episcopal Church that I attend hosts. I always love to go to that. And even though I may even go by myself, mm-hmm. I'm with people.
Yes.
And I'm in a moment. And I know that can feel lonely as well, but yeah, I am with people. I have been a part of something bigger than myself in a time. And then I also tell people, what is the thing you can do outside of yourself to give?
Okay.
Generosity. You know, we always talk about gratitude being important in our sobriety. But I think generosity, especially at this time of year.
It's all about service.
Yeah. What can I give? What can I give back? Because then it's not about me.
Yes.
You know, I have done something maybe in memory of someone, mm-hmm. or I have served in a way that maybe other people might not have been available, and I was. And I've taken part in things like that, and it's been more fun than even had I gone to, you know, the Christmas party I thought I missed.
Right.
But to engage in service,
yeah,
it's I think is extremely important. Get out of yourself. It's okay to be sad. It's okay to have regret. But it is not okay to isolate and live in the fact that you are simply alone and feel helpless in it.
Right, yeah.
I think that's asking for a lot of regret, potential resentment. And we all know what happens with resentment.
Yeah.
You know, save my sermon on that. But it's that's that place.
And resist the urge to give yourself a poisonous Christmas present, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because that, at the end of the day, you know, this season is about hope.
Mm.
And it's like all other feelings, and it's like all other emotions. Tomorrow it won't be Christmas.
Right.
And we will move on, and life will go on. Today, let's find the hope in it, in the moment,
yes.
in the waiting.
Yes, yes. So. Boy, that's such good advice. Hmm. Thank you very much. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Oh, we're back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. You know, we often say, David, in recovery, that expectations are just premeditated resentments.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's an old truism that hangs around because it carries a whole lot of truth.
Exactly.
Let's talk about, there is certainly kind of this season of, I guess we could call it expectation around the holidays.
Yeah, I think so.
Are there healthy and unhealthy ways to navigate the season?
Yeah, with regard to expectation.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, I think that expectation shows up more at this time of year. We expect more of ourselves. We expect more of other people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and maybe materially and maybe emotionally as well.
Right.
You know, they will come through for me. Because it's the holidays, maybe this time.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. You know, people will finally know how to love me perfectly because it's Christmas, as opposed to the rest of the year when they don't.
Right. Or rules will be suspended for a day. Or
yeah.
right.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we won't fall into all that other stuff today because it is the holiday.
Right.
The magic spell will fall upon us. And, you know, I tell people all the time, expectation is living with such a tight grip of demandingness. It's kind of like, you know, to use the Christmas analogy, the kid that looks under the tree and he is asked for a magic set.
Yeah,
for Christmas, and there is this big box.
Yes,
you know, and it had damn well be a magic set, or this whole holiday is going to be shot to hell, and
yeah.
not, you know. And so, if there's anything but a magic set in there, it's because he's asked for it. He's gone to Santa. He's written letters. He's done everything in his power. He knows to do to summon the Christmas forces to bring him this, and it had just better be there.
Yeah,
and what he doesn't know is it could be a puppy.
Right.
You know, it might actually be a puppy.
Yeah.
But we live in this close, tight-fisted expectation that if it's not this, and this is life. Now, I'm not just talking about our stuff.
This
is life. Like, if it's not this, if it doesn't come wrapped in this, then I'm going to be really pissed.
Yes.
As opposed to anticipation that lives with a loose grip. You know, expectations rooted in fear.
Mm-hmm.
Expectations all about fear and demandingness.
Right.
And we impose our fear and demandingness onto others when we, you know, live in that expectation of life must look like this.
Yes.
And we carry that all year long.
Sure.
You know, we just put a tree around it Christmas and hang lights on it. maybe they won't recognize expectation when it's all decorated. You know, but the star on top, it looks different.
Did you get my expectation card?
Exactly. Yeah. Happy expectations. but we do, and we carry that into life, and so we got this tight grip, and it had better be this, and life had better look like this,
mm-hmm.
and people had better come through for me in this way, as opposed to I tell people and myself, you know, if I can learn to live in anticipation,
mm-hmm.
where I don't know tomorrow, you know, I don't know what's going to show up in that box.
Yeah,
I may get my magic set, but I may get a puppy. I may not get anything.
Mm-hmm.
But what I do know is that if I live with a loose grip and I don't impose the expectation that paralyzes people in my life.
Right.
You know, they can't come through for me, and then they begin to withdraw, and I wonder why I'm more alone, and I don't understand that I have imposed so much on them that they cannot be, that it just paralyzes them,
and
they can't engage with me.
Right, sure.
Or not very pleasantly or safely. So, but if I learn to live in that anticipation, then I learn that life is a loose grip.
Yeah.
You know, life's about the tension in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the space.
Yeah.
And that anticipation can live in the space and have hope. Anticipation can have hope. Expectation never really can have hope.
Yeah, yeah.
Anticipation can definitely allow me to settle into what is and find peace. Expectation does not know how to do that because it's fearful.
Right.
You know, and so I try to think about that a lot, and how I may not always be doing that perfectly. And often when I feel alone and alienated, I wonder at times if I have imposed myself onto the situation so much that it just pushes people away.
And have I scripted the future so closely and passed the script out so that everybody knows the lines they're supposed to say?
Exactly.
Yeah. When really a surprise ending would have been a whole lot better.
I always talk about the Advent waiting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have this season of anticipation. You know, in the liturgical churches, anticipating the birth of
mm-hmm.
Christ, the coming of hope,
mm-hmm.
all of the things that represents. And I remember as a kid, I had a piano teacher that took me to the Philharmonic in our town every year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you would go in and the orchestra would be tuning up and playing and, right. you know, and it's just chaos, you know, cacophony of sound. And it's just no form because they're all warming up, tuning up. And I remember, you know, my mom would press my suit and polish my shoes and mm-hmm. tell me to walk on the street side of the sidewalk and be a gentleman. And I learned all kinds of things going to this the symphony with my piano teacher. But the cool thing was when you got there, you know, you're ushered to your seat and all this noisy stuff's coming from the stage. But all of a sudden, the lights dim. And one guy in white tails mm-hmm. comes out to the platform. And he raises his baton, and it's total silence.
Yeah.
And it's that little moment right before the most beautiful music, you know, we've ever heard is about to be played. And I think that right now, this is life under the raised baton,
mm-hmm.
where we live,
yeah.
you know, where we are, for all of us. We're living in the maybe the tension, maybe the anticipation.
Mm-hmm.
We're living in this place of holding our breath a little bit, because we don't know what life is going to bring to us.
Yes.
But we can loosen our grip and we can anticipate that it is going to be beautiful, it is going to wash over us, and it is going to be something we never anticipated.
Yeah,
new to anticipate that way. But living in that place of hope, that place of waiting, is like life under the raised baton.
Wow,
you know, and that's what this season feels like for me.
Mm.
Every year, it feels like that moment before the really good stuff gets here.
Yeah,
and I don't mean the gifts.
Yeah, yeah. You know? What a beautiful picture, David. Mm. What a beautiful picture, and a great way for me to frame this coming holiday.
Mm.
And I hope our listeners will do the same.
I do too. And I hope everybody has a very, very blessed season and a new year together of positive sobriety, but new health and insights and how to serve one another.
Mm. Yeah, who knows what beautiful music is coming our way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's been a great time having a chance to connect with you again. I so look forward to this weekly conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that about wraps it up for this week.
I think so.
We've got some great guests coming, I anticipate.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
And you can.
Yeah. They are, yeah. Well, we don't know the names of all of them, but we know we're going to have some great conversations in the year ahead.
We do.
Yeah, yeah. So until next time, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
We are your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.